I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. This year, about 700,000 Americans will have a stroke, and one quarter of stroke victims will die from the attack. However, with quick response and treatment, survival rates and recovery improve dramatically. On today's show, we'll talk with those who diagnose, treat, and rehabilitate those who have suffered from strokes, as well as those who are caring for loved ones. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Up to date. I'm Steve Kraske. When it comes to Americans who suffer strokes, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention classifies our 50 states into one of four categories. Missouri is in the not-so-good category. It's with a group of states that have the highest percentage of people who have suffered strokes. We're talking about 3-4% of all Missourians. Fortunately, Kansas is closer to the middle of all the states. About 2.5% of Kansans have suffered a stroke. Today, we'll talk about the latest in stroke prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation, and we'll find out exactly why it's so important to recognize early on the symptoms of a stroke and to get help quickly. With us today are two doctors who specialize in stroke from St. Luke's Neuroscience Institute. They are Dr. Cole Martin. Doctor, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you.
And also here is Dr. Brad Steinle. Brad, good morning to you, too.
Good morning to you, too.
Well, I'm just curious, Cole, let's begin with you. Do you work in this field because you've had, you know, some experience with stroke in your own life?
I became interested in stroke as a neurologist and found it to just be both a fascinating and very exciting field.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't because of a personal experience necessarily then?
No, not necessarily, but I've seen it affect innumerable patients over the years.
Sure. Brad, how about you?
Same for me. When I was an intern, I had a patient who had a stroke, and this was back in 1997. And as an intern, we don't know very much. And I looked at everything that we could do at that time for stroke, and there wasn't a whole lot that was out there other than the rehab piece. And so that really kind of guided me into doing rehabilitation medicine.
Yeah. You know, of all the things that I fear when it comes to medical stuff, you know, a debilitating stroke is probably pretty high on my list. Is that fear justified?
Oh, I think so. Overall, approximately 1 in 6 people will have a stroke in their lifetime.
That's amazing to me. Yeah. That's a lot of people, doctor.
And it's while stroke is a leading cause of disability in this country, it's also the number 2 cause of death.
Mm-hmm. You know, Brad, is my fear justified about what a stroke can do to the human body?
I believe so, because the stroke can cause paralysis. It can cause speaking difficulties. It can affect the way you think and the way you go about your everyday life. And so that's our challenge in rehab.
And to what extent these days can you reverse those kinds of effects of a stroke?
Well, this is one of the exciting things. In 1997, there really wasn't any kind of treatment to reverse stroke. And that's where Dr. Martin and his colleagues have really been successful at doing very innovative things here in Kansas City that are not really done anywhere else in the country, and certainly not to the extent or the time that they put in to help our people, our patients of this community.
Dr. Martin, give us a sense of what are you doing these days when it comes to rehab from a stroke?
I'll give the rehab component to Dr. Steinle.
Yeah.
On the acute or on the sort of the initial presentation of stroke, 96-97 was a watershed moment in stroke treatment.
Those years you're talking about.
Yes, we went from only being able to support a patient after they've had a stroke and start the rehab process to being able to intervene on the stroke and reverse it, which dramatically alters the natural history of the disease. Our staple therapy for treating stroke is a intravenous medication that breaks down clots. This is an area that St. Luke's has been very successful in both pioneering and leading the country in the ability to reverse stroke. In fact, our average at treating stroke with clot-busting drug is approximately five times that of the nation.
But the key there is to get the treatment quickly.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That patients essentially need to know to come to the emergency room immediately if they are suffering symptoms of stroke, such as numbness or weakness on one side of the body, difficulty speaking, or loss of vision off to one side.
How much time do you have?
Well, we used to think that you only had 3 hours. Now we're finding that there is some benefit to opening up the artery with a clot-busting drug up to 4.5 hours. And I think the revolution and what has really driven my career is now we're realizing that even beyond 4.5 hours after the onset of the stroke, we can still benefit patients by doing an angiogram procedure, putting a tiny device inside the arteries and try to pull out the clot that's blocked the blood vessel. This would probably be a good time to talk about, you know, what causes a stroke.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But just so I understand here, so you're saying the brain basically has, what, 3 to 4.5 hours before bad things begin to happen up there?
The damage can start almost immediately, but if we can reverse the stroke within a several-hour period, it dramatically improves a patient's ability to recover and lessens the burden on society.
Yeah. You know, Dr. Steinle, your colleague here just mentioned some of the groundbreaking things happening when it comes to rehabilitation. Tell us about that. What are you guys doing at St. Luke's these days that is noteworthy and might be of interest to people?
Well, one of the things I think that we do well at St. Luke's Hospital is that we get patients being seen by the therapy team within about 24 to 48 hours of coming into the hospital.
And that's important. Why?
Because we know that multiple studies have showed getting patients mobilized, getting them up, getting them involved with therapy, starting to try to help them move limbs earlier gives us better outcomes long term.
And I guess in the old days, what the idea was, you rest as long as it takes and we'll get you going whenever you're up to it.
Exactly. You know, patients might lay in bed for 1 to 2, 3, 4 weeks. And by that time, they've developed tightness in their knees and hip joints, and they just can't move because those muscles are so weakened and impaired by the stroke.
And that was just the opposite of what you're supposed to be doing then.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we also use technologies. We have equipment that we can put a patient into a harness, put them over a treadmill, and start have them walk even if they're paralyzed in one of their legs and one of their arms. They can do this, and they don't have to worry about falling or being dropped. And we know that there's been some really nice studies in the last couple of years that have identified the patients that we start getting up earlier, start working on walking. Even if they can't move their leg at that point, we can have therapists that can kind of guide them, but we can actually suspend them from the ceiling and in a harness over a treadmill and start walking within a week after a stroke. Now, not every patient can do this because they also have to have some truncal or be able to control their torso, but we know that that is a technology that can be quite beneficial in helping them recover from a stroke. We also use what's called functional electrical stimulation to muscle groups that have been partially paralyzed. We have a device that we can put on the leg that will help bring the foot up so they can clear the toes when they're trying to walk. We have a device for the arm that can cause stimulation to the muscles to help open the hand. The hand after a stroke will often be clenched, be what we would describe it as being flexed. And this device can help a patient open the hand as well as contract the hand to actually develop at least a rudimentary grasp.
So you're outlining a really a different mindset here when it comes to treating stroke, a far more aggressive, interventional kind of approach that really gets patients up and moving as quickly as you can get them up and moving.
Exactly. But I think this carries off of the entire institution. The things that, you know, I always think of Dr. Martin's team being on the front end, we're kind of working in parallel while they're doing their really, truly remarkable things to reverse these clots, to decrease the amount of impairment, we can get our team involved and try to maximize what they will be able to do functionally while the process carries on and they become medically stable and really can focus on rehab. Yeah.
Absolutely. There's no one magic element to having a successful program. And we're always looking for ways to improve our program. And this has been a process that's been evolving over now over 20 years. Now our patients can come in and they have approximately 50% increased likelihood of being functionally independent after the stroke when compared to other major stroke centers.
Are you saying that half of all your patients then, if I understood the stat right, half of all your patients then, Cole, can leave and be functionally independent after a stroke?
No, that's not the way the statistic was calculated.
Okay.
It's that of the of patients who do leave the hospital, you have a 50% higher likelihood of being functionally independent.
Okay. So that's much improved from what it used to be.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, let's, as you said a minute ago, let's back up and just talk in general terms. What is a stroke?
The most common type of stroke occurs when a blood vessel that feeds blood to the brain becomes blocked. And almost immediately, the brain tissue that depends on that blood vessel stops working. Then within a few minutes, the nerve cells begin to die.
So you have to move quickly to stop that then.
Absolutely. Some of our biggest saves have been in patients who have been quite near the hospital and come to the hospital literally within minutes of their stroke occurring. Now, depending on the patient's biology, sometimes, though, we can benefit the patient by opening up the blood vessel many hours later, and we just don't know until we bring the patient in, immediately scan them, evaluate the blood flow through the brain, and see if there's an opportunity to intervene.
Yeah, so what happens then Cole, if a patient comes in, and I pull up to your doors, and I'm feeling a loss of memory, and something's going on with me, and I know it. What do you do? What happens to you right away?
The most likely scenario is a family has noticed that there's something wrong with you.
I'm slurring. Something's
exactly.
happening. Yeah.
And many of our patients are completely unaware that there's a part of their brain that's not working because, of course, it's the brain that tells us the state of our own health.
So you get in the car, I come to St. Luke's, and what do you do with me? I come in and...
Well, you're not going to sit around in the waiting room.
Yeah.
You'll be immediately brought back. We have a nursing specialist who is available at virtually all hours, immediately begins the assessment, and you go into the CAT scanner.
How quickly can you tell whether or not, if in fact I've had a stroke or not?
Usually within a few minutes.
Really?
And
because you're checking what to tell that?
Well, the first thing we're doing is checking you physically. Are you able to move all parts of your body? We have a very efficient scoring system for the severity of the stroke. And then you go into the scanner. We see if this is a stroke caused by a blocked blood vessel. And then if it appears to be from a blocked blood vessel, as quickly as we can mix the drug and get back a few laboratory tests, you'll get a clot-busting drug to help open that blood vessel.
And how quickly does it take for the blood vessel to be reopened once that drug has been administered?
Everybody's different, and it depends on the size of the blood clot that's blocking the blood vessel. If it's a small blood clot, it may open within a few minutes of getting the blood flow. And in those cases, we see what we call the Lazarus effect. Our patient may have a severe stroke, and within a few minutes, they're completely back to normal. It's incredibly exciting.
Hmm.
But in patients where we're not seeing recovery, then we put them back in the scanner, look again at the blood vessels, find the blockage, and that's the point where I get involved to do a angiogram procedure and try to open up the blood vessel by pulling out the clot.
You actually go in and grab it, I gather.
Absolutely, as fast as we can get them back to the angiogram suite.
What does, Cole, what causes a clot to form to begin with and then to break loose and cause havoc in the human body?
The most common cause is a heart condition called atrial fibrillation. It's a form of an irregular heartbeat where the top parts of the heart aren't coordinated, and blood clots can form in the heart and then pass through the heart and be pushed up to the brain. Another common cause is arterial blockages in the neck from atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries.
And something just breaks loose and then off you go. And typically people are older when this happens. That's because why?
This heart condition, atrial fibrillation, it becomes much more common as we get older. And hardening of the arteries is a disease of age. It starts in early adulthood and then typically progresses over a course of a person's life.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get our listeners involved here. If you or a loved one has suffered a stroke and can tell us about your experience, give us a phone call. We'd like to hear from you. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. We're talking with two doctors from St. Luke's Neuroscience Institute, Dr. Cole Martin and Dr. Brad Steinle. It's called stroke. Why?
That's a biblical reference, actually.
Really?
Where a person looks normal and they're suddenly struck down.
That's simply what it is.
And before we understood biology, it believed to be a divine punishment.
The symptoms one should be looking for if you think you might have suffered from a stroke. Let me go to Dr. Steinle for this. What are some of the common symptoms?
Well, as Dr. Martin mentioned earlier, people can develop some weakness in an arm or a leg.
Yeah.
They can even notice that there's a sudden development that they can't walk quite right, or they start to slur their words, or they think of words, but they can't be able to express those words. They can also develop gait instability. They'll think that they're walking like a drunk. And there'll be a wide-based walking pattern, or they may fall. And the challenge is the people that become completely paralyzed on one side or the other, they know that they need to activate or the EMS or the emergency medical system and get seen because obviously they can't function. It's the people that develop some weakness. The prototypical Kansas farmer that developed some hand numbness on one side, but he's got to get crops cut. Sometimes we see those type of patients. They'll come in a day later after crops have been taken care of, and they've had a small stroke.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is back before 1997 or 1996, there really wasn't anything that we could have done. But now the things that Dr. Martin's able to do is time is of the essence. And so if you develop that kind of weakness or numbness, then you need to go to the emergency room and be evaluated. And Cole's work, Dr. Martin's work and his colleagues is just amazing. I came to St. Luke's in 2001, and we had a patient who was 91 years old. She was living up, I can remember her story very specifically. She was a 91-year-old female that lived up in Smithville, and she was in her Sunday school class. It was a Sunday morning. And she suddenly became paralyzed on her right side, and some of the people noticed that she couldn't speak. She got evaluated at the local hospital up north, was brought to St. Luke's Hospital. At that time, she was not moving her right arm or leg at all. They were able to go in and extract a clot. I saw her the next day. She could start to lift her leg off the bed, but she couldn't move her arm yet. 2 days, we start to get her up in therapy. She's starting to normalize the strength through that right side. She regains her speech. 4 days later, she goes home. Now, she does some outpatient therapy, but she was actually able to be discharged to home. Back before 1997, this patient very well may have died from the stroke, or they may have been so impaired
That's
by their swallow that they may have not been able to take nourishment. They might have been put on hospice at that time. So it's just fantastic, the work that Dr. Martin's team does, as well as his colleagues.
Dr. Martin, when someone is suffering a stroke and they're having trouble forming a sentence, for example, do they realize they're having trouble, or does it take other people to recognize what's going on typically?
It all depends on the part of the brain that's involved. When the right side of the brain is involved with the stroke, patients usually aren't able to formulate the concept that there's something wrong with themselves. But when it's the left side of the brain, then they're typically aware of the problem, although they may also be unable to speak, which of course makes it hard for them to seek help.
So those are some things to think about as you're watching your older mom or dad and going about their daily lives.
And it's, which is why educating the public. Right now there's an initiative going on to educate school children about stroke.
Why school children?
Because as their parents get older, their parents are going to have strokes.
Yeah. So help kids understand
Absolutely.
What this might be. Yeah. Okay. Lots of phone calls here. Let's go to some of the calls now. Marge from Overland Park. Marge, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. Dr. Steinway, you treated my husband after his stroke at St. Luke's about 9 years ago. You also called him Doctor. His first name is Bill. And he had a stroke. He was actually at St. Joe. And finally, after about 3 or 4 hours, they identified him as having had a stroke because he didn't present with all the common symptoms. And so they rushed him to St. Luke's, and they did what was then called a Roto-Rooter procedure by Concentric Medical. I can't recall what the device was called.
That would have been a Mercy device.
That's right. That's right. And he was up walking and talking the night, you know, less than 24 hours after his stroke. And then he was at St. Luke's for several weeks and then went to the Rehab Institute for his therapy, which was fabulous. So between the two places, we are so lucky to have both facilities in the city. And he's doing great. Nobody knows he had a stroke except for me and my kids and very, very other close friends of ours.
Oh, that's neat. That's a great story, Marge. Thanks for sharing it with us. Okay, bye-bye. Let's go to Paul from Overland Park. Paul, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
My question is about strokes among African Americans. Statistically, is it higher? And if so, why?
It is a bit higher, but also the types of strokes are different in African Americans. African Americans typically have more problems with high blood pressure. And now, while high blood pressure does cause all forms of stroke, it particularly is a strong risk factor for bleeding inside of inside the brain, and we can see with an increased frequency of the bleeding types of strokes, which I hadn't discussed before. Most strokes are caused by a blockage of a brain artery, but a stroke can also be caused by a bleeding from a brain artery.
One other quick question. Are there preventative measures that we can do to lessen the possibilities of strokes?
I think the answer to that is yes. Am I right?
Yes. The two strongest things we can do to prevent stroke is to, if you have high blood pressure, make sure that the high blood pressure is well controlled, and the second one is not to smoke.
How about other racial groups?
We see a similar pattern in Asians compared to along with African Americans, where high blood pressure and the bleeding forms of stroke are more common. In Caucasians, particularly in older women, we see atrial fibrillation or an irregular heartbeat as being a chief risk factor for stroke. Now, these are generalizations, and you can't make the assumption when a stroke patient comes to the door that they'll have one particular mechanism of stroke versus another.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, update@kcur.org. You know, as a percentage of the population, are we seeing more or fewer strokes year after year? Any sense, gentlemen?
Well, it's hard for me to say, and I think that as the population is living longer, I think we're seeing patients that have stroke in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, which, you know, 20 years ago, people didn't live as long. And
so in theory, because we're living longer, we should be having more strokes. We have more people on the planet, so this is more common.
This is.
About 15 years ago, we saw a reduction in the stroke rate as medications to lower cholesterol became widely available and well-tolerated. And as we started to treat blood pressure more aggressively, the number of strokes decreased. Now those same patients are still alive, and they're having strokes now at a later age.
So the numbers might be going back up for
yes.
that reason, then, you're saying. That's interesting. Let's grab one more call here before a break. Pam from Lawrence. Pam, you're on the program. Good morning.
Good morning. My question has been partially answered because I was calling about the bleeding in the brain that causes the stroke. My father suffered from that when he was only 59 years old. He was a very active farmer and always just the epitome of health, but probably had high blood pressure. I don't know. He didn't go to a doctor. So he had that. And my question now is, you've talked some about once someone has a stroke and they go to the hospital, the things that you can do if it's a blockage, what can you do if it's the kind of stroke where it's the bleeding in the brain?
Bleeding in the brain can come from one of two mechanisms. Well, three, really. One mechanism, obviously, is head trauma, which doesn't apply here. Another is from a ruptured aneurysm. An aneurysm is an outpouching of a blood vessel where the blood vessel is weak and then ruptures. The majority of aneurysms, well better than 80%, we treat at St. Luke's with a procedure called coiling. It's done with an angiogram, and we basically feed a tiny little tube into the brain artery at the point of rupture and then patch that point of rupture with these platinum wires called coils.
How do you do that? In 20 patients, words or less.
Yeah, the patients are kept under a general anesthetic, and we're able to navigate the blood vessels of the brain with these catheters that are about a millimeter and a half across and with a wire that's about 10 one-thousandths of an inch across. And
that's amazing to me.
I have a follow-up on that. Are people who have this type of stroke and the procedure that you do then for them, are they able to recover at the same, what seems like now miraculous rate as what you're able to do for the people who have blockage?
Recovery from a ruptured brain aneurysm is very different, and it tends to be a much longer process. Dr. Steinle, can you comment on that?
Well, the statistics are that actually the mortality from a ruptured aneurysm or a hemorrhagic stroke or a bleeding type of stroke is greater within that first 30 days.
Yeah.
It just depends on the extent of the brain damage that occurs from the bleeding to the brain, because we know that there's considerable inflammation that goes along with blood products in brain tissue. And so, but we do see some people after that, if they do survive that 30-day period, that can recover some varying degrees of function, even better than some of the folks with the ischemic or the type of clot stroke that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. My father went on to live till he was 81, so he did okay, but didn't recover a lot. I mean, he lost a lot of function of his left side.
Hmm.
So keep up the good work.
Pam, thank you for the nice call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about strokes. We'll talk about a little more about prevention. We'll also talk about how families can cope more effectively with a loved one who has suffered from a stroke. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about the secrets of Trader Joe's, you'll find it in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, we'll learn about Woodrow Wilson's First Ladies, also the future of Kansas City's proposed streetcar system without that $25 million Tiger Grant, and finally Brian McTavish and our weekend to-do list. This hour, we're talking about stroke. We're visiting with two doctors from the St. Luke's Neuroscience Institute, Dr. Cole Martin and Dr. Brad Steinle. Now, Cole, there's a new initiative at St. Luke's. It's referred to as the Healthy Imagination Solution Site. What are we talking about there?
This is an initiative that was put together by General Electric, of all people. They are seeing it important as a multinational corporation to advance health care, and they're seeking areas of excellence. And they've identified stroke, particularly St. Luke's, as being a area where if we can sort of disseminate how it is that we do our successful things, that it can make a big impact in society.
And that's why you're here today, right?
It is. Yeah. I spent the last 2 days discussing our stroke center with neurologists in New York City from several other countries. And then some of those neurologists have come to St. Luke's today to see firsthand how it is that we're able to intervene on with ischemic stroke or blocked arteries at 5 times the national average. And then by the time you throw in the angiogram procedures, we're at 8 times the national average of stroke intervention.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times emergency providers bring stroke victims to St. Luke's just for the reasons you just outlined, right?
You're referring to the paramedics?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, we have a very close relationship with the paramedics in Kansas City, and they know that if they bring a stroke patient to us, we'll work it up quickly and do everything we can to reverse the stroke. And if the stroke can't be fully reversed, we've got the medical support and the rehab support to get a person through their hospitalization and maximize their chances of a good outcome.
Let's just talk about prevention just for a couple of minutes, gentlemen. You know, what should be done to prevent a stroke? I know there are things about lowering cholesterol and looking at blood pressure. What about if you're an older person listening to this show, are there things that even folks who do those kinds of steps should be thinking about, Brad?
Well, I like to keep things simple. If you think about the initiative that's been put in about cardiovascular disease, the risk factors that involve cardiovascular disease or reducing heart attacks are the same things that we need to do for reducing risk of stroke, because we know it's a vascular disease problem. So things like, again, lowering the cholesterol, trying to eat a heart-healthy diet, lowering salt. If you have high blood pressure, you need to take your blood pressure medicine, mm-hmm. seeing a doctor regularly to have these all assessed, and certainly being seen to identify family risk of stroke is very important as mm-hmm. well. But, you know, this is always humbling for us physicians, but if you smoke, the most important thing to reduce your risk of having a stroke mm-hmm. is actually stop smoking. For secondary prevention after somebody has had a stroke, that is the most powerful reduction of risk for a secondary stroke is stopping smoking. So we always encourage our patients to stop smoking.
What about someone listening to this? You talked before about brittle blood vessels and what happens when folks get older, that being a cause of stroke if something breaks off. Is there anything you can do to lubricate those vessels to help prevent that kind of thing?
There's two ways I think that we can help to mitigate the effects of atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries.
Right.
One is medication such as aspirin helps to prevent the clotting cells of the blood, the platelet cells, from sticking to those rough spaces and then closing the artery, sending blood clots up to the brain.
You take a couple low-dosage aspirins every day is what I've been told.
Yeah, an aspirin a day, really any of the doses are effective. And then diabetes is also a very potent risk factor, and patients who have diabetes should seek to keep their diabetes under good control with medication and diet.
Okay. Let's go back to some phone calls here. Shirley from Raytown. Shirley, good morning.
Good morning. I turned on my radio just a little while ago and heard you announce that Dr. Steinle was on the phone, I mean on the radio.
He's right here.
Yes. Hi, Dr. Steinle.
Hi.
Anyway, my husband is a patient of Dr. Steinle's. He has suffered several strokes over several years. He started getting them about 60s, and he has continued to have them. And if it was not for St. Luke's Neurological Group and Dr. Steinle, how the hospital worked very quickly. Ralph also had, a couple of years ago, he had to have a stent surgery because his arteries were closed almost all the way up into the brain. And they put stents in and saved his life, and he is just doing beautiful. He has some problems. But The rehab department there is just outstanding on how they work with patients, and then also they bring you home to do rehab even in your home where you have physical therapy comes in and works with a stroke patient to help get them mobile and going again. And so I can't sing better praises to St. Luke's on how they have saved my husband's life.
Shirley, I'm glad to hear that. And I'm also wondering, how was this for you, watching your husband go through this? How did you cope with it?
It was extremely hard, but the chaplain service there is wonderful. The stress of seeing my husband unconscious and having to, the family has to encourage a patient. You have to keep pulling them to keep working because they would rather not do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be strong enough to say, come on. You've got to do these exercises. You've got to keep fighting because that's part of the battle.
Well, and I don't want to violate HIPAA regulations by being a hypocrite, but I think you also, you and your husband took advantage of our caregiver training program at St. Luke's Hospital, along with the outstanding therapy team that we have. We have a unique program that involves caregiver training, and it's a dedicated social worker that she's kind of the program, but she will take the initiative, visit with the patient, the family, the therapist, coordinate everything that a patient might need to have a safe discharge to home. Again, without sharing too many details, some of our patients have impairments when they are discharged to home, and so they need caregiver training. They need a spouse, a loved one, a family member to be able to provide some assistance. And so a lot of times family members don't know how much or how little to help. And so this program helps smooth that over. And we're really the only hospital in the city that has this type of program. Mm-hmm. And we were supported through St. Luke's Foundation to start this program probably 8 years ago. And it's been a big success. We probably help 150 to 200 families and patients a year that probably would not have been able to discharge directly to home through this program and training the patient and their family to be able to provide the care that he needs.
That's interesting. Shirley, thank you for calling. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Nolan writes us this at UpToDate at KCUR.org. Does the increasing weight of our population affect treatment, numbness, and diagnosis of strokes?
It does. Primarily as a risk factor of diabetes, obesity does impact our rates of stroke in this country.
Mm-hmm. Robin writes us, this is there a correlation between migraine headaches and strokes?
There is a small increased risk of stroke in young adults who have migraines, and the mechanism of that is not well understood.
Okay. We also have a note here from, let me just find it here. Let's go back to some phone calls here. Rebecca from Kansas City, Missouri. Rebecca, good morning.
Good morning. I wondered if the doctors might comment on strokes in infants. I represented a guy who was charged with sort of this shaken baby syndrome. And I hired a doctor to look at the medical records, and much to my surprise, he wrote me back and said that the infant had had a stroke.
Mm.
So I up, and it basically said, what I could read online was that there was a U-shaped curve and that there were as many strokes in infants as there were in the elderly. So I wondered if they might comment on that and the possibility of misdiagnosis of infants who have had a stroke and then their caregivers are accused of shaking them and causing the injury.
Yeah, thanks, Rebecca.
Well, we both take care of primarily adult populations, but there is, we see patients that infants are, that are, that have stroke symptoms are often referred to as children that have cerebral palsy, which can be a mechanism of stroke. I can't speak specifically to to what you're describing, other than the fact that we know in adult populations, if there is violent head trauma from a fall or a motor vehicle collision, the blood vessels can actually tear and can lead to stroke too. That usually involves Dr. Martin's expertise in looking at the blood vessels in a radiologic fashion to see if there's been a tear, and that's usually referred to as an arterial dissection.
Dr. Martin.
I think an important takeaway message here is that stroke isn't just an illness of older adults, and it can happen. And it can happen at any age, even a young, healthy adult. If they have a numbness or weakness on one side of their body, they need to seek help immediately.
John in Overland Park writes us this: "Gentlemen, I spent 6 months in the hospital because of brain infection a few years ago. There was brain damage, and I suffered a stroke-like symptoms. 5 years later, my life is back to normal, but I still have weakness in my left leg and arm. My left hand is particularly bothersome. Fine motor skills, like piano playing, have never returned. Also, when I yawn, it clenches painfully. What would you recommend for therapy or exercise at this point, so many years later?"
Well, if you remember the exercises that you were taught by the physical or occupational therapist, that would be important to do.
Mm-hmm.
Again, when I was in training, we used to believe that people have maximally recovered after a stroke or other brain injury at 1 year after the stroke. We do see through what's called a functional MRI that we can see that there is what we describe as cortical remapping of the brain. For instance, a patient can have a stroke in the right motor center of the brain, and there'll be no activity on these functional MRIs. As patients start to recover, we see other areas of the brain that will start to light up or activate as a patient can recover. Now, we've seen people that after even 5 to 10 years after a stroke, if they're maybe working with an occupation or a physical therapist, that they could regain some further function. A lot of the things that we do in rehabilitation is all based on repetition.
Mm-hmm.
And so continue to practice the technique that the therapist has taught you can sometimes help you recover further.
How arduous is all this?
Oh, it's very hard. I use with my students an example that if they're right-handed, I ask them to write with their left hand.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so that's somebody who's had a mild stroke. I teasingly ask them to remove their shoe and then ask them to write, put a pin on in their feet or through their toes and try to write with that. Sometimes that's how a patient with a stroke might feel after they've been partially paralyzed on one side. It's just a very foreign type of loss of ability to function. And so the patients that recover the best are the ones that work the hardest. Our therapists do a great job of cajoling patients to do the therapy.
The patients have to take the load on their back.
They have to take the initiative.
Yeah.
And work outside of what they're doing in therapy to try to help them recover further function.
Patrick from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning. You're on Up to Date. Our topic today, strokes. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good. Thanks, Patrick.
A simple question. Where do people go after the insurance has run out and they can get help from the hospitals and all, where do they go to get continued therapy for their stroke?
Good question.
That's an excellent question. That's a thing that we are challenged in our society, having programs that can continue when after a patient's had a stroke and their therapies run out or what the insurance will cover or what Medicare will cover. Here in Kansas City, we do have a program called the American Stroke Foundation. They have initiated an alliance now with the Kansas City YMCA to do some of these lifetime wellness programs for patients who have had stroke or other brain insult.
Mm-hmm.
I will make a disclosure. I'm on the board of directors for that program, but I've been on that for a couple of years, and they do wonderful work. The challenge that we have, even in the community our size, is we don't have enough of these facilities out there. That was one of the exciting things that we saw with the YMCA, that because the YMCA is everywhere. If we can get more lifetime wellness for patients who have sustained a stroke and be able to get them into those facilities so they can continue to exercise, make the healthy lifestyle choices that hopefully the rest of us do. That'll be real important for the recovery.
That's the voice of Dr. Brad Steinle. He's from the St. Luke's Neuroscience Institute. He's also joined today by Dr. Cole Martin, from St. Luke's. Again, our number 816-235-2888. And we talked just a little bit about families, but I guess it goes without saying, you know, Brad, that, you know, families themselves, this is a whole new world for most folks as well that they're entering into, along with a loved one who has suffered a stroke.
Well, that's correct, Steve. I described the patients that they're in the driver's seat with their stroke, but the family members are right in the passenger seat. So they have grief that's associated with the loss what their loved ones experienced too. So that's where it's real important to work as a team. One of the really great things I think that I get out of rehab medicine is that we do work with teams. We have nurses that are dedicated to help patients regain function. We have therapists that work really hard. We have this caregiver training program. We have social workers that are dedicated to this to try to maximize what a patient can do. Rehab really involves two processes. We're trying to maximize a patient's to recover after a stroke, but along with that, we have to prepare a patient to return to the community with the impairments that they're exhibiting at the time of the discharge. And so that's where our caregiver training program helps us out. It is a challenge. You know, the truly hopeless cases for us is the patients that have had a stroke that have no family member, no social support to help them when they are discharged. And unfortunately, those are the ones that usually end up in long-term care.
You know, someone who's a stroke victim and has suffered a loss of communication ability, they can't speak very well. I imagine sometimes their brains are still working okay. And how do you deal with that kind of frustration with a victim?
Well, this is a real exciting area, too, with some of the technologies that we are all exposed to using iPods, iPads. There's an area that's being developed in computer software that are looking at ways to help patients communicate better. We refer to this as augmentative communication, but there are now iPads and iPods that have programs that patients can type and they can sound out the words. That serves two purposes. That improves their ability to communicate others, but also can be a therapeutic training technique that they can reinforce the exercises that they're doing with a speech-language pathologist.
There's also a new emphasis on singing therapy. Am I right about that, Brent?
Well, there is, because we know that some of the arts activities of the brain occur in the right side of the brain, and language, some of the dominant language areas are on the left side of the brain. And so we will have patients that may sing the ABCs or sing 1, 2, 3 or...
Yeah.
And that really can help augment the therapeutic technique. We call that melodic intonation training. Mm-hmm. And we're still pretty primitive in what we can do with communication compared to everything else that we can do with stroke, unfortunately.
What about experimental magnetic pulses I've read about?
Well, this is another exciting area, too. We know that the brain, basically, or the nervous system, works on electricity, and so there are stimulation devices that are being used. We were actually involved with a study where we implanted a stimulator onto the surface of the brain to try to help with recovery. These are still highly experimental, but I think there holds some promise with this in the future.
You know, Dr. Martin, what is the acronym FAST, F-A-S-T? What is that?
It's been developed to help both healthcare workers and the general public recognize symptoms of a stroke and then what to do about it. F for face, recognizing that one side of the face isn't working properly. A for arm, asking a patient to lift their arm and seeing if they can maintain it against gravity normally. S for speech, is the speech slurred or the words coming out jumbled? Mm-hmm. And T for time being so critical to getting the patient into the hospital for stroke reversal.
A good word to remember if something like this should happen. Yeah. Let's go back to some calls here. Sonia from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on Up to Date, Sonia.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My call is two-part, and I believe the first part was addressed
I was interested in the neuroplasticity, so the window of time from when the rehabilitation doctor works with somebody into the time where you are no longer seeing any significant changes in function. And then addressing a family that would maybe hold on to the desire to keep seeing changes, and when you would have that conversation with a family to say, let's start talking about how you can now move forward, kind of exit therapy, you know, outpatient therapy, and learn how to live your life with what you do have.
Yeah, we got about 30 seconds left. Let me go to Brad with that. What about the first question about the rehab time compared to not seeing changes in function down the road?
Well, I spent a lot of time talking to patients about getting rid of the idea that they need to have indefinite therapy. Now, sometimes patients might need tune-up with therapy, but they really need to take grasp personally of doing the exercises or having a family member help them. And that's where lifetime wellness programs can help us too. I really try not to tell patients that they're not going to get further recovery, because we're not clear on who those patients are that will continue to show optimal progress. So it's a real challenge, but we need to keep patients motivated. But I think they also need to get back to maximizing the things that they enjoy doing and getting back into the community.
And just very quickly, dealing with families then, her second question?
Same thing. I mean, we need to get patients back to into the community, living life.
Dr. Steinle, Dr. Martin, thank you both for your time. Good conversation
today.
Thank
you very much.
Appreciate
it. Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Brad Steinle, Dr. Cole Martin, both from St. Luke's Neuroscience Institute. You can learn more about them and get more information about our program at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, learn about Woodrow Wilson's First Ladies, also the future of Kansas City's proposed streetcar system without that $25 million tire grant, and finally Brian McTavish in our weekend to-do list. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.